Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For several decades now, schools have been working to more fully include children with a variety of disabilities. Yet there is a group that can be especially hard to integrate and educate: kids with emotional or behavioral disabilities. The numbers bear this out. These students have poor graduation rates and are more likely to be arrested or end up in a halfway house or drug treatment center. Still, some question this whole concept of disability when it comes to emotions and behavior. They ask why these children are being labeled for what might just be a lack of self-control, and that some old-fashioned discipline would go a long way toward cure. Others, though, insist these children have profound problems and require individualized support from well-trained teachers, along with a positive school climate that embraces inclusion. Now these issues are explored in a new documentary film called Who Cares About Kelsey, which follows the story of Kelsey Carroll, a Summersworth High School student suffering from ADHD and the after effects of homelessness and substance abuse. The film makes the case that alternative approaches can help students like Kelsey beat the odds and succeed. This hour on The Exchange, including students with emotional and behavioral disabilities. And let's hear from you. If you have personal experience with this issue, what do you think? How fully should this group of kids be integrated into the classroom? What feels reasonable? What doesn't? What do you think makes this inclusion work well? And when doesn't it work well? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests in studio: Dan Habib, filmmaker in residence at the Institute on Disability at UNH. His new film is the one I just mentioned, Who Cares About Kelsey. It'll be premiering this Sunday at Red River Theaters in Concord. You can go to our website for more information if you'd like, nhpr.org. And Dan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Christine Martin, principal of Manchester's Webster Elementary School, a magnet school for students with emotional and behavioral disabilities. And Chris Martin, thank you for making the time. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Also with us, Alan Pardy, executive director of the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators. And Alan, thank you also for being here.
You're welcome. Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dan, I want to spend a couple minutes with you since your film is what got us started on this conversation. And listeners might remember that your first film was also about public education and inclusion, guided by your family's own story about including your son, Samuel, into full school life. So how did that first documentary, Dan, called Including Samuel, spawn this new film, Who Cares About Kelsey?
Well, as you say, Including Samuel focused mainly on Samuel, who has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair. And as I've shown the film around the country probably 400 times in about 35 states, I found that the same question kept coming up. And people would say, what about kids with emotional and behavioral disabilities? Can those kids be included as successfully as your son Samuel? And I remember one day in Buffalo, I was at a screening, and this woman started talking next to me about what it took just to get her child out the door every day. You know, they had to have just the right clothing on, just the right food, you know, meltdowns, and she was in tears. And I just started thinking, this is a powerful story that needs to be told. So I started doing some research and found that the outcomes for a lot of students with emotional and behavioral disabilities are very poor. As you said, about 60% do not graduate from high school.
Wow, that's a lot.
Right. Many end up incarcerated on the street, and about 65% are not included in general ed classrooms. So it's a very complex subject, and I started thinking, how can I tell this story? Fortunately, where I work at the Institute on Disability, I have some great colleagues, and one of my colleagues, Joanne Malloy, said, look at this school, Summersworth High School. They're doing some remarkable things around a school-wide system called Positive Behavioral Supports, as well as some intensive youth-directed planning called Renew for kids with the most significant disabilities. I spent about 3 months just spending time in the school, documenting school life, and then I met Kelsey, and I said, all right, I know who I want to do this film, how I want to focus this film, and I spent the next 2 years documenting Kelsey.
Well, just give us a quick sketch of the film, Dan, since it's brand new.
Sure. Kelsey is a girl who is now 21, but when I first started filming her was 19, a senior in high school, had just about everything going against her, you can imagine. She came from a family with some very big challenges. There was a lot of substance abuse in the family. She was self-mutilating earlier in her high school career. She received no credits freshman and sophomore year, was failing.
No credits.
No credits. She was staying back. She basically saw no possible way that she could graduate. She had ADHD, you name it. There was, you know, her sister was a teen mom. So basically the thought that I had was, how does a girl like Kelsey intersect with the school in a positive way to change that trajectory? Because she was on a trajectory towards the juvenile justice system, early pregnancy, substance abuse. And the film is really about what happens her senior year when her whole trajectory has changed through some incredible work that the school was doing.
And how is the challenge of including Kelsey the same, Dan, and maybe different as the challenge of including Samuel?
That's a great question. You know, I think that part of what the challenge is with kids with what I would call hidden disabilities is that a lot of people judge them very quickly and judge their families and say they're just bad kids. And I don't really think there are bad kids. I think there are kids who have had difficult things happening neurologically or in their mental health. There are kids who have had difficult things happen in their life who might be suffering from post-traumatic stress. But I think with the right supports, Kelsey can be included just like Samuel. And I feel just as passionately that kids with emotional and behavioral disabilities benefit from inclusion just like Samuel, because it connects them to their peers, to their communities, to the resources they need to be successful in school and beyond. And it gives them access to general education, which is the best that our communities have to offer in general.
Well, let's bring Chris Martin and Alan Pardee into this too. And I think to you, Alan, first. So when we say students with emotional and behavioral disabilities, I mean, who are we talking about? Who are we not talking about? And what are your thoughts on what Dan says about, you know, the general attitude towards students with these types of disabilities? You know, we just think they're pains in the necks, they're bad kids.
Well, Dan's points are well taken. I think there's a misunderstanding of many kids with emotional disabilities. These are clinically assessed and evaluated by a number of individuals before a youngster is identified with an emotional disability. And it excludes kids who are socially maladjusted. It's not the kids who we would normally think of as a juvenile delinquent or the old term. But these are kids who go through a team evaluation, and often they are exhibiting behaviors in school that are problematic. But not always. There are kids who are depressed who don't exhibit outwardly behavioral disabilities. But the high-profile kids certainly get the attention. And as Dan says, the odds are sometimes stacked against kids with emotional disabilities because schools are not therapeutic environments.
So are we talking depression? Are we talking
anxiety,
schizophrenia? What are we talking about?
Schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, which are fairly common. There's a variety of also traumatic experiences that kids experience, as Dan referenced. And teachers are not typically trained to deal with that. They're not clinicians. They're not therapists. And so one of our concerns as special ed directors is that we have the best trained staff possible and that we also provide an appropriate program for kids with disabilities. That's what the law requires, and we have to make sure it's appropriate. And sometimes inclusive settings are not the most appropriate setting.
So sometimes you're included and sometimes you're not.
Sometimes we are, sometimes we're not.
And we'll definitely get into strategies and so forth in just a minute. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to hear from you too, Chris Martin. So who are the children at your school, again, Webster Elementary in Manchester, who would fall under this category?
Sure. At Webster School, we have 471 students. The majority of them, about 450 of them, come from the community that surrounds Webster. They could walk to school or be bused within a couple of miles. But the children in our magnet program are referred to Webster School for a more restrictive environment from other elementary schools. So they may have been diagnosed, as Alan said, supports would have been put in place in their elementary school in town, and it would have been deemed appropriate that those supports were not enough and that we needed to have them in a more restrictive placement. So they referred to our program where we use positive behavioral intervention supports. So we address behaviors and try to make it as normal an elementary classroom as possible with providing great elementary school experiences for them, knowing that their behaviors are they're very high intensity students. And it's an absolutely wonderful program with a lot of wonderful successes.
Well, and we'll hear about that in a couple of minutes. I want to hear from Kelsey herself. Again, as you said, Dan, when many people think of disability, they think of someone with a problem that they're born with that isn't their fault and that may defy cure. Here's how Kelsey describes her issues herself.
Most people don't understand my attitude, my sense of humor, my hyperness. My family doesn't understand it either. Obviously, if you spent a little bit more time with me talking more about how I am, you'd understand that, yeah, I've had a really crappy life, and a little bit of caring will take me a long, long way.
Again, that's Kelsey Carroll. She's the subject of a new documentary called Who Cares About Kelsey? It's about the challenges of including and educating kids with emotional and behavioral disabilities in mainstream classrooms. We're talking about that issue this hour with the filmmaker Dan Habib and two other guests, and let's hear from you, too. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800- 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email. The address, exchange@nhpr.org. And, you know, all of you, getting back to what we just heard from Kelsey, Alan Pardee, to the uninitiated, it sounds like growing up in difficult circumstances, as Kelsey herself says, having a crappy life, doesn't constitute a disability. Can you address the skepticism that having a crappy life doesn't mean you have a disability?
Well, I think that's probably, it's not the only, certainly it's not a definition. And what schools have to figure out is whether an experience, whether it's trauma or a crappy life or other experiences, mental illness, whether those impact academic achievement in school or social achievement and behavior. And that's really the challenge for kids in special education settings. However, a lot of kids with behavioral issues are not in special education. They're going through the normal school day. They might or might not be getting treatment by an outside counselor. So it's a rather elusive concept in terms of trying to pin down why a youngster has behavioral disorders, but it has to be based on observation, evidence, and some assessments. That
so it's not just randomly assigned.
It's not just random by any means.
Dan, what are your thoughts
there? I also think, as Alan referred to earlier, there's a stereotype, I think, that kids with emotional and behavioral disabilities are always freaking out, running out of the classroom, you know, violent. As Alan said, it can cover a lot more ground. Impulsivity, hyperactivity. Yes, there can be aggression, but there can also be feelings of low self-worth, depression. And the one of the barometers is, does it negatively impact your educational and developmental performance? And it has to have that negative impact. In the case of someone like Kelsey, it's not one thing. And for most kids, it's not one thing. There might be something happening neurologically. There might be some mental health challenges. In Kelsey's case, there was some abuse early in her life that she has post-traumatic stress from. So it's a real cocktail. And for a lot of these kids, it's a combination of the environmental factors they may have experienced as well as what's going on chemically and neurologically.
Wow, a cocktail. So a cocktail that exhibits itself in a variety of ways too, Dan, right?
Right, exactly. And in Kelsey's case, you know, I think one of the big challenges is she was struggling academically. And for a lot of these kids, when they struggle academically, they will exhibit behavior to get out of that academic environment where they feel unsuccessful. So one of the themes that I hope comes out of this film is that behavior is a form of communication. It's not random. They're exhibiting this behavior because they're trying to communicate something. We need to figure out what is it that they're trying to communicate.
Wow, that's a lesson for everybody who works with kids. We will start taking your calls after a short break. 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and more on including students with emotional and behavioral disabilities on The Exchange on NHPR. At 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly sunny. High temperatures from 65 in the North Country, ranging to 75 in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, clear, cool. Lows around 40 north, ranging to 50 in the south. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Drellian from Cirque du Soleil, coming to Manchester with a fusion of East and West. Opens May 30th at Verizon Wireless Arena. Tickets at CirqueDuSoleil.com. From Hypertherm, an employee-owned company that designs and manufactures advanced metal cutting systems here in New Hampshire, online at Hypertherm.com. And the University of New Hampshire School of Law, now offering a dual JD MBA program with the Whittemore School at UNH at law.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, including emotionally and behaviorally disabled children in our schools, we're exploring this issue through a new documentary called Who Cares About Kelsey? We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477 if you have personal experience with this issue, either as a parent or as a teacher. How fully do you think this group of children could be integrated into mainstream classrooms? What feels reasonable to you? What doesn't? What does it take to make this inclusion work well? When have you seen it not work well? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests. Dan Habib is here, filmmaker in residence at the Institute on Disability at UNH. He is the filmmaker of the new documentary, Who Cares About Kelsey? Also with us, Chris Martin, principal of Manchester's Webster Elementary School, a magnet school for students with emotional and behavioral disabilities. And Alan Pardee, executive director of the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators. And all of you, before we go to the phones, I did want to talk about, okay, we've talked about what we're looking at here with this population of kids, some of the issues that they struggle with. So, Chris, to you, Dan mentioned a high percentage are not included in regular education. 65%, I think, is what he said.
Sure.
Your school has a magnet program for students with emotional and behavioral disabilities, students who were referred by other schools. So in a way, you're including them at Webster School, but in a way, they've been excluded from their home community school.
Yeah. If you look at, there are about 6,000 elementary school students in Manchester, and we have 21 students that are in a more restrictive placement for emotional disabilities.
Just 21?
Just 21. The rest of our children with emotional disabilities are included in the classrooms around the district. So I think we're doing all right in the percentage department in that regard. Also, because we want to keep those programs small for the intense needs, this morning I just reviewed what we refer to as a Form U I received from another school for more restrictive placement for a child for next year. We scrutinize that Form U and make sure that all kinds of supports have been tried in the child's neighborhood school before they're sent to Webster. I mean, ideally, the kid needs to be living in their house, playing with kids that live next door, going to their neighborhood school.
Right.
And if we can provide supports to make that happen, we want that to happen.
Dan.
And I think it's wonderful that Chris is the leader of that school and that they have her as a resource. You know, the thing that's so challenging is that nationally so many kids are being segregated. We have to think, why are so many kids being segregated in separate placements? Because I think unfortunately a lot of schools see that as the first place, and then kids need to earn their way out.
Yeah.
Versus looking at it as, what is the least restrictive environment, which is the law, you know, for a child, which is a general ed classroom. Can we make it work for that child? Can we provide the proper supports and interventions so that they can have access to their friends, to their peers, to their community, to general education? And unfortunately, I think a lot of schools have not looked carefully at enough like approaches like positive behavioral supports. They haven't done the right type of assessment work or early screening work. They don't implement programs like response to intervention, which looks at literacy challenges and educational challenges for kids when they're very young, and says, you know what, if we don't address these educational challenges now, these kids are going to get more and more disengaged and frustrated with their education, and they will start exhibiting behavior even if they haven't already. So there's so many approaches that I've tried to capture in this documentary project that I hope more and more schools embrace. And the percentages that Chris just talked about are great in Manchester. That should be more of the national profile.
Wow. Although all the items that you just ticked off there, Dan, sound expensive. I mean, and schools are already, you know, looking at cutting music and art and so forth.
You know, they're really not. In the sense that a lot of this is about looking at the way we do business, and are we using our resources in the best possible way? It's not about throwing more money at things.
You don't need more bodies to do this?
I'm actually part of a team at Runlet Middle School here in Concord that's helping to implement positive behavioral supports at the school. There hasn't been an influx of money. There's just been a tremendous teamwork to look at all the discipline policies, all of the ways that we've tried to build school climate and culture, and are we doing it in the most effective way? Are we making data-driven decisions? Are we looking at the data and saying, you know, we've had this policy in effect. Is it really making a difference? And that's what they did at Summersworth. They looked at, say, kids not allowed to wear hats every day. And they said, why do we have this policy? Is it really doing anything? And they finally said, you know what? We're just creating a lot of battles for ourselves. Let's get rid of it. They also looked at their cell phone policy and said, you know, we're not enforcing this consistently across the school. If we could enforce it consistently classroom to classroom, there'd be so many fewer battles. So that's what this type of work looks like. It's not about spending more money necessarily. It's about looking at the way we do business.
Alan, can you talk about that too, please?
I would agree strongly with what Dan said. It's not always about money. As a director, I was able to bring 7 kids back from out of district and actually spend less money with 3 staff on the grounds of our high school, separate building, but the kids were able to be integrated for part of the day. And I also think that at the local level, it takes leadership and commitment to bring kids back and have kids included. So you need administrative support for that. And a third point I'd make is PBIS is a wonderful opportunity for staff to get together, talk about common expectations, consistency, so that everybody is talking the same language to kids, same expectations, and behaviors are very clearly laid out in terms of what's expected.
PBIS is positive behavior.
Intervention and support.
Intervention and support. Yeah. Okay, and not to beat the money horse to death, Chris, but, you know, Manchester schools are really in a tight financial place.
Yeah, there's no question that we have had our challenges, but I've been a Manchester educator for 23 years, and we've been having challenges for 23 years. And we seem to find a way to do good things on behalf of kids with the resources that we have. You know, our program, I would agree with Dan, it's about appropriate professional development. Do the adults that work with these children have the right strategies at hand to do what they need to do for those kids? And though sometimes the pairs of hands are certainly necessary, I don't look at it as a budget concern. Going forward, though, I mean, certainly my counselor in the Emotional Behavioral Disabilities Program has been received a pink slip. We brought her on board. We searched her out. We've trained her. She's built a relationship with kids. And so I am sure I'm concerned about her leaving us next year and the impact that has on kids. And it agitates me to think, you know, we did a good thing. She's a great thing for our kids. And it might not be there next year. So that's very problematic.
If I could just add one more economic factor. If you look at, there's been a lot of studies done around dropouts, and obviously a lot of kids with emotional behavioral disabilities are dropping out. There's one study that showed that from just looking at the class of 2008, if we could measure the lost income over the course of the lives of all those dropouts, it would add up to $319 billion mm-hmm. over the course of their lifetime in lost income from all those dropouts and lost productivity to our society. So I could go study after study that shows if we don't address these issues early on in kids' lives, if we keep them in school, being successful, graduating, hopefully going on to higher education and employment, we will save the country so much money.
Go ahead, Alan.
And one other point I'd like to reinforce about relationships, it takes caring adults to really connect with kids. And if you talk to kids who've dropped out, they'll often say, and there's a long-term study years ago that said the most common comment was, nobody cared. Nobody had a connection with me. That's why I left school. So it takes those caring adults committed to kids and holding them in that system.
Yeah, and again, and I know you've all said it's not really about the money, but boy, teachers, administrators, school counselors, you know, most of them aren't sitting around twiddling their thumbs. I mean, they've already got a lot of stuff to do. So I just wonder, you know, when they find the time, Alan, to be that person when they're, you know, grading kneecaps and all the other testing and everything else that they have to do.
Well, it takes a certain personality type, I think, to work with very challenging and difficult behavioral issues. But also it means, again, support from administration that says we will give you the resources and the time to do this.
All right, let's get our listeners involved. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. As we look at the issue of including students with emotional and behavioral disabilities, we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And first up is Sydney in Amherst. Hi, Sydney, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you this morning? I'm really enjoying the program. I'm sitting here trying to decide whether to sign an IEP or not. And I've been struggling with my school system this entire year. And I find that the administration and the bureaucracy is such a well-oiled machine, and usually the end result is you have to sign it. I've never been approached as interim services, but you've got to sign it, and it's like a Wonka bar. You can get the golden ticket. And I do want to go immediately to what the speaker spoke of recently about administration and the lack of connectivity. I agree completely that the children primarily want to feel heard. Kelsey had said something about caring. And I want to know how the teachers do not have time and why aren't they having the time to understand the kids, because it starts when they first start the school. They don't fit in. For some reason, they're not fitting in. The other kids pick up on it immediately. And it's the lack of picking up on to getting in that creates these behavioral issues. I completely
agree.
Sydney,
can I ask you a quick question? So you said you're trying to decide whether to sign an IEP. That's an individualized education program, right? And that kind of gets you into the whole special education system.
The educational process is just loaded with an acronym.
Right. So why is this a tough decision for you?
Because I'm absolutely scared. My son went K through 6 through the local school area here in Amherst. And I have another child, too, who has been diagnosed with another disorder. Put him in a Catholic school because I thought maybe he would enjoy the structure. Begged the school because of his bullying and teasing, his not fitting in, and to I was fingerprinted in the area so I could easily have fit into just providing a classroom where the kids could do games during games.
But why are you scared? Excuse me for interrupting, Sydney, but why are you scared to sign this thing?
It's a legal contract. Mm. And basically this entire year, my son, I took him out of school, diagnosed with Asperger's ADD. I independently, Hollowell Center. Hollowell's a very good name. You guys know him. And I went to BG for a while. And the bottom line is I put him back in with a bunch of promises.
Okay.
None of the promises were made. And the problem is, too, is with Kelsey, I'm sure, too. Promises are continuously made to these young, developing children. Promises. And when they're not followed through by the adult figures, how can they have trust?
Right. Let's talk about that. Well, Dan, go ahead.
First of all, I have so much respect for teachers, and whenever I spend a day in a classroom or a school, I'm exhausted at the end of the day and say, how do you do this every day? So with all the films I've made, I hope are embedded with this idea that teachers are doing amazing work, and they're working very hard. The question is, can we work smarter and not harder? And that's what when you say something like caring, yes, teachers do care. They wouldn't be in this business unless they cared, all educators. But you need to kind of create a system where that caring has very specific and positive effects on the student body. And one of the things I've seen work in my process of working on an IEP with my son Samuel and also worked with Kelsey is involving the student all the way through the process. We have Samuel sitting in now on our IEP meetings. He's helping to make the decisions. Kelsey was actually driving the decision-making in her planning meetings and identifying her own hopes and dreams. So the key is make sure that your child feels connected to their education and that their education feels relevant to them. And a lot of kids, they don't. Other adults are planning for them and they're not engaged in the process.
Well, in Sydney, you know, others feel probably the same way you do, though, scared to sign that piece of paper. I mean, Alan, you know, I've got something here, an analysis of the advantages and disadvantages of labeling, talking about how labels shape teacher expectations. Labels send a message. The problem is with the student. Labels can exaggerate a student's actions in the eyes of a teacher. Labels constitute stereotyping. I mean, it's a big deal to sign that thing.
It is a big deal, and Sydney's right. It's a legal contract between the district and the parent that the district will provide certain services. However, parents can always ask to revise the IEP, as can the district. It's anybody's option to reconvene the team meeting. And I think it's unfortunate that we've become so legalistic in special education. I always like to tell team members when they sit at the table, anything that's happening or being discussed, the question is what we're about to do going to give this child more support? Or are we just simply filling out the paperwork? And there's a real struggle to stay away from just filling out paperwork.
There's another point, though, that sometimes comes up, and I'm not sure who wants to tackle this one, but sometimes you hear parents like Sydney, I don't want to sign the IEP. It's a contract. It's a scary step. Other times, maybe I'll throw this to you, Chris.
Sure.
You hear, yeah, parents are trying to code their kids and label their kids as fast as possible so they can get those great special services that quote-unquote regular kids don't get.
Sure. Well, I want to speak to the signing the IEP because I have to sign that IEP in my school. I'm the district's legal person at the table. And when I look at that IEP, I look carefully at all of the reports that went into putting together that IEP and the supports and the goals for each of those children. I take that very seriously. And when things aren't going well, we go back to the table. And that constant communication with the parent and any other providers to that child is significantly important. It takes a village to properly work with a child with an identification. You know, do I see parents who are, I've heard the expression, shopping for a diagnosis? You know, occasionally we do, but usually that's based upon a level of frustration that something's not going right. They're seeing something that's not right, and so they're pulling at whatever they can to try to make that happen. And so from our end, again, it's about communication. Let's work with, what can we do for that parent that's going to help that child succeed?
I guess real quickly, too, I think more parents and students feel the stigma of having a label or a disability than they would be looking for that kind of services. And that's why one of the reasons I think inclusion is important to look at is because when you do have that separate room or that separate placement, although sometimes it's necessary, it does create a real stigma for that child.
All right, let's take another call. Sydney, good luck to you with your child. And Malcolm is waiting in Durham. Hi, Malcolm. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Dr. Malcolm Smith from UNH Cooperative Extension. And I think there's a 900-pound elephant in the room that we have to talk about here. PBIS is a great program, and all these efforts are great, but the fact is that kids are really uncivil towards kids with disabilities, that we're seeing a meanness in the schools that we've never seen before. And until we really get at that issue, at bullying and peer victimization, we'll never, ever see inclusion work.
Can I challenge you a little bit, Malcolm, and thanks for calling in, a meanness that we've never seen? Never?
That's correct, and I'll tell you why. Our kids have changed dramatically. We're seeing that, for in- instance, we've just been testing kids around New Hampshire on empathy scales, looking at their ability to understand, to walk in the shoes of other kids who have problems. And we score much lower than kids around the world.
Okay.
And those scores are going down. Our kids are becoming meaner, Laura.
Okay. Well, Malcolm, you're the guy who studies it, so I'll take your word for it. And a couple comments from the folks in the studio. I think Chris Martin first, and then Dan?
Sure. I'll try to be brief. Though I respect Malcolm, and his work is unbelievable, I don't have the data that he has to support my theory, but I do know kids, and I do know the kids at my school. And what I see is our kids being very sensitive and very compassionate and very understanding. And that's one of the great benefits of having the program in our school. And I'm very, but it takes some effort on the part of the adults to make people aware. You know, we're the people in this room are not all the same. We all have our issues. I have an anxiety disorder. You don't know that. And so you didn't treat me any differently this morning. You know, we need to teach that we are all different.
I think, you know, Malcolm's point is well taken. It does take a lot of work to build a sense of community and a sense of respect and acceptance within a school community. And I think that one of the things I've been intrigued by is thinking about what creates the bully. And Kelsey was a bully earlier in her high school career. And I think that she was a bully because she wanted power. She felt powerless because of a lot of things that happened in her life.
And she was so frustrated.
She was so frustrated. She had suffered abuse. There was a lot of things in her life. So she was trying to seize that power back. So although I think justifiably there's a lot of attention focused on these days on the victims of bullying, we should also look about what makes kids into bullies and how can we prevent that from happening.
So sometimes the kids that have disabilities are bullied, but you're saying sometimes they are the bullies, like Kelsey, because they just they have this rage, they're frustrated, they can't figure it out like the other kids can.
Exactly. And as Chris said, I think if we create a sense within a school that we want to understand that kids are different, that this is part of the natural diversity of our society, that some kids have emotional behavioral disabilities, they're disorders, they have something that they can't always control, that needs to be a focus within our school dialogue, that this is a real disability. And Johnny, who's acting out today, there's something going on in his life or in his mind that's causing him to do that.
Alan, I do wonder if this inclusion movement that we've seen in the last, you know, 10, 20 years has the potential to reduce bullying, because you are exposing kids at very young ages to people who are vastly different. I mean, I remember including Samuel. The kids in the first grade that grew up with Samuel thought nothing of the fact that he had difficulty with some daily tasks. So I wonder if inclusion reduces bullying.
I think it may. I'm not sure we have the data that support that. It's certainly easier at the elementary level than it is at middle and high school. But one thing I would suggest is that we ought to really support any school that's looking at a social-emotional curriculum, teaching teachers about social-emotional development. The only state that I'm aware of that actually has a state curriculum on social-emotional development is Illinois. And we certainly would support schools doing that.
Okay, coming up after a break, I want to talk about the other kids in this school. Since we've gone down that path, I want to explore a couple more avenues with you. We'll take your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477. So keep them coming in.
The White Mountains Attractions Value Pass grants you and a friend entry to 16 attractions around the state, including the Conway Scenic Railroad and the Mount Washington Cog Railway. You could win a pass this week as part of NHPR's Merry Month of May when you put your name in the hat by making a donation to NHPR and the news at nhpr.org.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Southern New Hampshire Medical Center and Foundation Medical Partners, working together to design healthcare around you, where you live and work, snhhs.org. And from Edgewater Farm, River Road, Plainfield, with over 2,000 varieties of flowers and vegetable plants, and the staff committed to help with all of your gardening needs, edgewaterfarm.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, educating and including students with emotional and behavioral disabilities into the mainstream classroom. We're looking at this issue through a brand new documentary film called Who Cares About Kelsey? Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. If you have experience with this issue yourself, either through your child or your own experience growing up, how fully do you think this group of kids could be, should be integrated into mainstream classrooms? What feels reasonable? What doesn't? What makes this inclusion work well? When doesn't it work? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And all of you, I want to bring another clip of the film in, Who Cares About Kelsey? This has to do with how teachers sometimes struggle to integrate these kids into the mainstream class. We're going to hear from math teacher Devon McNelly in the film. And just to let listeners know, while he's talking, we see and hear Kelsey moving around, getting up, offering gum to classmates, just being really what most of us would call inappropriate and disruptive.
So this is multiple events. So this is the probability of a green, a yellow, and a green. This is in a row. So what's the probability of picking a green, a yellow, then a green? Probability of yellow after the green. Okay, so green,
you know those stuff
green,
with the,
yellow,
the white powder on top of gum?
Green, mm-hmm. Yellow.
It's ground up marble.
Kelsey, I have a question for you.
Okay,
yeah.
Are you going to have difficulties today?
Yeah, at least for another 20 minutes because my medicine isn't picking up.
Okay.
First impression of Kelsey was, man, I hope I never get that kid in my class. Because you know what, teachers, like, I want the trouble kid. You know, I want the kid who's going to, like, throw things at me. And then sort of my first interactions with her were pretty pleasant. So I was like, ah, this kid's, like, a pretty good kid. A little rough around the edges.
Because you're picking three marbles out? You listen to me? Three marbles.
I don't know whether she'll ever lose the rough around the edges. You know, some people just have an edge to them.
So
again, that's Summersworth High School teacher, a math teacher, Devon McNelly, in the new documentary film that we're looking at, Who Cares About Kelsey, a film about how to include kids with emotional and behavioral issues in the classroom. Filmmaker Dan Habib is with us, along with Principal Chris Martin of Manchester and Alan Pardee with the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators. And before we go to the phones, all of you, you know, Dan, you first, listen to her. I mean, I was so mad at her watching that part of the film. You know, be quiet, sit down. I was thinking of my own two kids. You know, they're there. They want to concentrate. They want to learn the math. And Kelsey is getting in the way.
Right. I could totally see how you'd see it that way. And I have to say, teachers sometimes have the patience of saints. They usually do. But I think that what I found in Summersworth is that teachers never gave up on kids. They understood that a kid like Kelsey was going to be tough sometimes to work with, but they would never give up on her. And I can't tell you how many adults since I've been making this film have told me, oh, you should have seen me as a teenager. What a screw up I was. And now they're, you know, doctors or lawyers. And I think that's part of it, is saying that, listen, a kid like Kelsey is going to have some challenges. What I found also is that when you have a lot of peer support and peer education going on within a classroom, it's the peers that sometimes know how to de-escalate
the other kids,
how to support each other in some ways much better than the adults. So it wasn't that there was never consequences. I mean, as you heard in that exchange, Mr. McNelly was saying, okay, what's going on here, Kelsey? Kelsey said, I just need my meds to kick in, then I'll be okay. He said, okay, let's move on. They had that quick dialogue. It was quick. It was quiet. It was unemotional. And they moved on. And that's kind of the style of education at Summersworth.
Yeah. What do you think, though, Chris? I mean, put yourself in the shoes of a kid who doesn't have an emotional or behavioral disability.
Right.
He or she is trying to learn, and she is just getting in the way. I mean, is that fair to the other kid to have her in that classroom?
It's all about the adults. How do the adults handle the situation? And in that case, that's a perfect example. So there's something going on that shouldn't be going on. You redirect, cue, keep teaching, redirect, cue, keep teaching, redirect, cue. And if you need more support, you get more support at that time. But if you make a big deal about it, stop what you're doing, focus on the behavior that's inappropriate at that time, you're going to escalate that situation. It isn't fair for kids when things aren't going well. That means the adult needs to do something different. If the child isn't behaving, therefore the adult needs to change their behavior. It's not about the kid. Now, it's easy for me to say that's the perfect world, and that's the goal that we're working towards all the time. We are successful sometimes, and sometimes we are not successful.
So, at what point do you pull her out and say, "Look, Kelsey, you know, Susie and John need to learn their math, and you're just getting in the way"?
Well, I would assume that Kelsey has a behavior plan, and every child with needs like Kelsey should have a behavior plan. So the teacher would then have to follow through with the plan. If X, Y, and Z are not working, what's the next step in the plan? And it might be, in fact, to call Ms. Martin.
Alan, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
I just want to also pick up on Chris's comment about fairness, what's fair. And what fairness means to me is that kids get what they need, not that everybody gets the same thing.
Mm-hmm. But all kids get
all
what they
kids
need.
Get what they need. And if there's a youngster being disruptive in a classroom, the teacher does have to deal with that. They have to figure out, however, what supports that student needs. And sometimes it's going to be in another setting, maybe for a brief time. But fairness means getting what you need, not that everyone gets the same thing.
I also think there's a misconception that this means there's no discipline or no consequences. That's not the case at all. What I saw in Summersworth was the discipline was well thought out. So in many school districts, a kid escalates, they get detention where they sit and do nothing, or maybe they have some nice time with a teacher they like. So there's almost an incentive to get that detention, or they get suspended from school. And I've done a lot of interviews with incarcerated youth as part of this larger project. And I've had kids tell me, I love getting suspended. I would go home, I'd sleep in, I'd drink, I'd find a girl and have sex. I mean, that's what they were doing during those days suspended. So there was a huge incentive to be suspended. So I think the disciplinary consequences have to be very well thought out and constructive.
Now, Manchester, Chris, has called in the police at times, right?
We have a policy, a procedure, where we have to file an incident report with police when an adult is assaulted by a student in any school. That has happened. And I applaud Manchester PD, Scott Legacy, Lieutenant Legacy from Manchester PD. The conversations that we're having is more about therapy and correcting behavior, which is what we're trying to do. I mean, discipline, even in the judicial system, is about correcting and changing behavior. So when I apply discipline to a child, any child at Webster, the question is, what do we need to do so this behavior doesn't reoccur? If it's a behavior plan, and it's not going to be the same for every child. There's no cookie-cutter discipline that's appropriate.
Well, let me tell you a quick story about a story I heard from some middle school kids, and I know a lot of middle school kids. So there's a kid with what they call issues, right? That's their way of putting emotional and behavioral disabilities. And Alan, you know, the kid with issues starts sort of taunting them or calling them names. And so, of course, being sixth graders, they call him names back. And then the kid with issues throws a very large, heavy metal water bottle at the other kids. Kind of hurts, but who gets put in detention and who doesn't? The kid with issues doesn't get put in detention, and the quote-unquote normal kids do. So there's a feeling among kids that it's not fair, you know, that these kids get special dispensation because, oh, gee, they have issues.
Well, that's
and that kind of breaks down the whole system of, you know, discipline in a school.
And that's one of the difficult areas within special education is that youngsters with disabilities have to go through another step in terms of discipline approaches. They have to do what's called a manifestation meeting. And if the behavior is related in a direct way to the disability, then there are some alternatives instead of perhaps being expelled or suspended. So that's a very tough area to deal with. But I do want to point out that one of the challenges of schools and teachers is to help kids learn to make better choices. And sometimes kids don't really have in their head a clear idea of what a better choice might be, and they need to be explicitly taught. Instead of throwing the water bottle, I could simply leave the room. And sometimes they really don't know what else they could do.
Right. I mean, we take for granted that we're going to teach math, we're going to teach social studies, we're going to teach English. We don't necessarily say we're going to teach behavior. Right. But as Alan just said, we also need to teach behavior. We can't assume that every kid is learning that in other ways.
All right. Well, lots of people who want to jump in here. And let's go next to Concord, where Steve's been waiting. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. One is that I'll just give you my background. I do have two kids that one had Asperger's and one with ADD. They're both in college now. But we were in the Oyster River School District, and they did an excellent job, including both of those kids. And I just wanted to give a shout-out to them. But also, I'm a nurse at the Sununu Youth Services Center. And so I kind of see the other end where these things don't work.
Wow, the other end that Dan talked about. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. And one thing I noticed is that teachers are expected to be social workers and in some cases therapists and things like that. And when there's support for that in the school, it works. And when there isn't, it doesn't.
Yeah, and Steve, this is a great point. It's what we talked about earlier. You know, teachers today aren't sitting around twiddling their thumbs. How do they find the time and energy to do this extra social work support right. that Steve talks about?
Well, teachers can't do it alone. There's no doubt. And I've interviewed kids at the Sununu Center, and most of those kids, something started happening at 10, 11, 12 or even younger that put them on that path. What is an ideal situation is when you have something called wraparound supports. When you identify a kid who needs significant supports, like Kelsey or maybe the kids at the Sununu Center, you bring in people from the community, from the behavioral health centers, social workers, psychologists, whoever the school has as a resource. Bring them in. Family members, of course, should be part of that process, and the youth themselves. And you figure out, as a team with the youth involved, what is it that's going to make you successful? What is it that's triggering this behavior? You do something called a functional behavioral assessment, where you look and see what are the triggers that we can see occurring again and again that escalate the behavior. So it has to be a very thoughtful process, and educators, teachers cannot do it alone.
Do you think, Dan, that a large percentage of the kids you interviewed at the Sununu Center, and just to let people know, that's sort of the juvenile justice facility. Can you roughly say how many may have some emotional and
sure, I could say on a national level, they look at 70 to 80% of youth who are incarcerated have some sort of diagnosed emotional behavioral disability.
And so if we could deal with that, we'd be emptying out the juvie justice system.
We would be, that population would rapidly decline if we could be addressing these issues a lot earlier in their lives.
You know, real quickly to you, Chris, we did a show on this last week or maybe even earlier this week. What's the role of medication in helping these kids manage their issues?
Sure. It depends on the diagnosis, of course.
Sure.
Something that we don't get involved in on the school level, any testing that we do on the school level gets referred to the child's pediatrician, and that's a decision a parent makes with the pediatrician. But as I said before, you know, it takes a village. We're looking at the school piece, the medical piece, the psychotherapy piece outside of school, and of course that communication with the home and that warm and loving home with the welcoming school. If you can put all of that together and things are functioning well, you generally have a kid who's coping well with their disability. When those pieces aren't working together, it's not a good deal.
That's a lot of pieces.
It's a lot of pieces, and it's complicated work. And I just want to say really quickly, you know, how can a teacher have the time to do this? Maybe this is insensitive, but we never promised you a rose garden. This is difficult work. And we only get one shot to do good things on behalf of kids. We can't make mistakes. So step up, and we just need to do it.
Let's take another call. This is Cara calling in from Northern New Hampshire. Hi, Cara. Go ahead.
Hi. The reason I called is I grew up with I have four brothers and two sisters, and I'm the oldest, and I have three brothers, actually, that have learning disabilities. And my last brother came up through the system. The first two brothers had a resource room sort of thing. And my last brother, my mom went through the system, very good support team, the whole nine yards. And, you know, he was tuitioned out, but he actually is doing very well. He's older now. And as a parent now, I'm very sensitive to, I think, and it's very important to my children that they are sensitive to, you know, everyone has their issues, like you said earlier in the show. Every person has something different about them that they need to work on. But what bothers me is that I work with my children quite a bit, and both of my girls, I'm very fortunate. You know, they love school. They're both doing well. But I,
Cara, we're nearing the end of the program. I'm wondering if you can just wrap it up, and I do apologize.
I'm so sorry. I think what bothers me most is I feel as though my children are, and I know it's public school, but my children are, you know, the kids with the special needs are always the ones that get all the attention. And I'm fortunate that I'm able to give them extra things outside of school. But what about the parents that aren't able to do that? And I think that's what bothers me, and we need to find a balance.
Yeah, Cara, thanks
a lot
for calling in.
I'll take any comments off air.
Oh, sure. Thanks for joining us. Dan, this is sort of the question we were talking about before.
Yeah, I think many schools have found the balance. I think that, you know, this is America, and you get the type of education, hopefully, that you need. And that's what I see for every child. And not every child needs the same thing, as Alan Pardee said earlier. But I have been looking at schools that are finding the balance, and it's usually not about money. It's usually about leadership. It's about having the right attitude and the right training for the staff. And it's about family engagement and youth empowerment. So everybody's kind of working together. I wouldn't say it's the rocket science, but it's pretty close. It's hard work to do this well.
I had a neighbor who taught first grade in Nashua, and I remember Alan, she said to me, I spend 90% of my school day on two children in my class. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what Cara's talking about.
And that's unfortunate. But in that situation, the teacher clearly needs to ask for help from the administration and maybe get some other resources into that room. If that's how she's spending her day, then it is unfair to the other kids because they're not getting what they need.
Like Kara's. Like her kids. Yeah. Do you have thoughts, Chris, on Kara's situation?
Yeah. No, and I would agree with what Alan said about the teacher who spends 90% of her day. When I don't have an assistant principal, I have a part-time assistant principal. I can spend 60% of my day as a principal dealing with behaviors in the building.
Wow.
And it is what it is. I would concur that it is public education. Everyone is welcome. And are all the adults involved in that situation aware that that teacher is spending 90% of her day? And what supports are being given to her? That's the key.
I think the key to the positive behavioral supports is that it's about prevention. It's about stopping the behavior from escalating or happening in the first place. And you do that through building a school-wide community that is full of respect and has the right supports in place. So a lot of kids never get to that point of escalation. And then when kids do have significant needs, you address those needs in a way that's effective. So I think if schools were looking much more at prevention, early screening, and figuring out ways to stop the behavior from escalating in the first place, you wouldn't have teachers with that kind of disproportionate time usage.
And you talk about early screening, and that's the product of first grade, right? We're probably just in the beginning of a diagnosis of some issue that may be going on with the child. So that's the you know, there's a special place in heaven for first grade teachers.
Or even preschool.
Absolutely. Preschool, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, all of you, as we wrap up, how do you see, Alan, the state education establishment and so forth evolving on this issue of including this group of kids, you know, with the hidden disabilities that Dan talked about before?
Well, it's certainly a challenge. We're in challenging times, but I can't recall a year that wasn't challenging. But economically, we're certainly struggling with budgets and resources. But I think it's important that school leaders, building principals, superintendents, special ed directors, have conversations with their staff about the need to educate their folks about social-emotional development just as much as they talk about literacy and math.
Dan, go ahead.
I think it's important, too, for kids to experience, quote-unquote, the real world. And the real world isn't full of people who act the same way, talk the same way, walk the same way. This is actually going to help kids grow, to be around kids who are different from them.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you very much for being here. And again, the film will premiere at Red River Theaters in Concord. Go to our website. More information, nhpr.org. Dan Habib, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Dan Habib, filmmaker in residence at the Institute on Disability at UNH. Again, the new film, Who Cares About Kelsey? Alan Pardee, it was good to see you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Alan Pardee, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators. Chris Martin, I know you're super, super busy at Webster Elementary School. I appreciate you taking the time.
Happy Friday.
Chris Martin is principal of that elementary school, a magnet school for students with emotional and behavioral disabilities. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. We have help this week from Todd Bookman. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.